have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Scott Craven, our guest. He is an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors, and certainly looking forward to hear what's on your mind. So, what wildlife questions do you have? Maybe you've got a photo. Maybe you've got an animal you want to have identified. You can join the conversation. Give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send your questions and your photos to ideas@wpr.org. And, of course, love to have you participate. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, listeners. It's great to be back on. I wish we could get back in the studio and do a few other things, but I guess progress is being made.
Progress is being made, and I think progress is being made by some wildlife when it comes to damage to your home and the area during the wintertime. Let's talk about that a bit. Which are the most destructive in your mind?
Well, in terms of winter problems, it's hard to move past deer. They're big and conspicuous, and they become pretty bold. In my own case, I've got about a 10-foot pyramid-shaped arborvitae or white cedar about 6 feet from the front door. And I'd say that every night for the last week or two, there's been at least one and sometimes several deer literally right there by the front door, visible on the Ring doorbell and so forth. But nevertheless, they've got that pruned down now pretty well, so it looks like a palm tree. And that's a little annoying. It'll grow back eventually, but it's in the meantime, the shape and form and everything else is pretty much destroyed. So those are very visible, but there are steps that can be taken. If I got ambitious, I'd wrap the tree in chicken wire or some such thing and put an end to that. But it's too darn cold to be out there. But anyway, that's another story. A little less visible are the voles, most people call them field mice, but meadow voles are active all winter, and now that we've got heavy snow cover around southern Wisconsin, those little guys are working away in our yard mulch and around the shrubs and bases of fruit trees and things like that, doing damage that won't be seen or discovered until the snow melts in the spring. And then, of course, there's rabbits and assorted other things that join in the mix. But there's a little bit of good news. It's going to be so brutally cold for the next week or so around here that a lot of those animals will just stay, other than the voles, which are protected under the snow, will just stay denned up and out of harm's way for a while to avoid that cold. Now, northern Wisconsin, depending on what this storm tomorrow does, little different situation. They've got relatively little snow cover, and that provides a different set of problems. So there are lots of things going on, but you know, we tend to talk more about that in the fall, actually, when people can take some preventative measures to keep the things from happening. Right now with the voles, for example, sit inside, stay warm, grit your teeth and bear it, because there's not a whole lot you can do until spring, when there's another cycle of control opportunities.
Yeah. And of course, with that heavy snow in some areas of the state, like in Madison area, for example, I know the rabbits now can get up a little higher on top of the snow to at some things they couldn't get at earlier.
Right. So that causes problems for fruit trees, rose bushes, things like that. But the additional problem is that besides the damage, the deep snow that we've got, and especially if there's freezing rain like they're predicting a bit of, that makes it really tough for animals that need to scratch through or dig through that snow to find food. So turkeys will have a tough go of it for a few weeks. If there are any pheasants left around your property, they'll have a tough go of it. And some of the songbirds will be a little more dependent on our feeders. But it is, I mean, we're here on the 3rd of February, so we're on the downhill side a little bit. And theoretically, the average daily high temperature is slowly creeping up. But unfortunately, this week it's going to be not so slowly creeping down.
You know, there was just another topic. There was a lot of rhetoric last month about having a wolf hunting season in Wisconsin. I see there's even now a lawsuit against the DNR for not setting up a hunting season for wolves right away. But maybe you could talk about the background on that and where kind of where it's at.
Well, we can, yes, we can certainly talk about the background and the current situation. But at least if the Natural Resources Board close vote last week holds sway here, there will not be a wolf hunting season until next November, which is what the DNR had planned anyway, giving them time to meet their obligations to confer with the tribes in Wisconsin and do what needs be to set up the mechanics of the hunt and the quotas and the like. So the hunt is scheduled for next November, but the fuss was that when they were delisted a month or so ago, in other words, taken off the endangered species list, and they've bounced on and off the list for as long as we've been doing the radio program, Larry, so that's just a foregone conclusion. But they were removed from the list, and I think with just cause. That then places their management back in the hands of the states in which they reside. So Wisconsin then could have a hunt. They can take additional steps to control depredations, and those are in place now. A farmer who sees a wolf or a rancher who sees a wolf in the process of chasing sheep, cows, or anything else can legally shoot the animals now. And but the hunt was something else again, and that in part relates to state law that said, well, when wolves are delisted, then there should be a hunting season. So there's a little bit of weasel room for interpretation about whether that should be immediate or whether it goes through the planning process of the DNR and we end up with a season next fall, which is what where we currently sit. The fly in the ointment, well, there are many flies in this ointment, Larry, and I hope we don't open a can of worms with the discussion, but the fly in the ointment is that if the inevitable lawsuits are filed, not the one that you mentioned, we'll get to that in a moment, if the inevitable lawsuits are filed by wolf advocates and protection groups that, hey, they shouldn't have been delisted in the first place, in some cases in the past, history would suggest that as those suits go through federal court, it's possible that there would be an injunction that would temporarily halt plans for a hunt until the court cases are resolved. And of course, all parties understand that, and that's part of the game, so to speak, but that can drag on for years. So the immediate cry from some factions in Wisconsin was, hey, the law says we should have a hunt. They're delisted. We should have a hunt now, here in the middle of winter, even though typically that was a fall and early winter phenomenon when we had hunts 6 or 7 years ago. There are many problems associated with this, Larry, one being some of the requirements to confer with the tribes and other people who have a stake in the management. But the other one's biological, and that's that a hunt this late in the season could be extremely disruptive to wolf social behavior and what they're doing this time of year in preparation for mating, breeding, and reproducing, and so on. Now, people who want wolves hunted and essentially removed from the landscape probably aren't too concerned about those detrimental biological impacts, but the DNR has to be concerned with that kind of thing. So there's where we sit. This was very contentious. Some people calling for an immediate hunt, some people arguing that, hey, we'll get things up and running next November, and some people still arguing that they shouldn't have lost their legal protection in the first place. In any event, the DNR board did vote last week after hearing all these considerations. I think it was a 4-3 vote. It was close. That there would be no season this winter. It would proceed as planned next November. Now, the new wrinkle that occurred and it came out in the news this morning was that a Kansas-based hunting group called Hunter Nation has filed suit to open an immediate season using quota schemes and assorted other things from the past. I don't know what their thinking is in terms of how this would be planned. They just want to be out there, to have someone out there hunting wolves like yesterday. And I don't know where that suit will go, but it's kind of a, you know, there are people all along the spectrum here, just like there are in current politics, and that's what this group is doing. But there we have it,
and that's and I think we're not even going to take any more calls on it.
Well, that's fine, Larry, because to be honest, there's just a ton of interesting news items that relate to wildlife. There's a lot of stuff on bird feeding and the results of the hunting seasons and those garden catalogs you met. There's a ton of stuff to talk about. Let's let the wolves rest for a little while.
And you mentioned bird feeding, and Nick in Green Bay has a question that I think relates to that. Nick, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got two questions, actually. The first one is, I've got like five or six bird feeders up, and like there's tons of birds in the backyard. It's amazing. And then all of a sudden last month, they just disappeared. They just don't go there anymore. And I was over at the neighbor's house, and she's got a feeder up, and she's got chickadees like crazy, but 10 feet away to my house, there's nothing. And then my other quick question for you is, I got a really cool bird in the backyard, a red-tailed hawk, and he's awesome. And, you know, my bird feeders are just a smorgasbord for him. But I noticed he sits on the tree, but I was wondering why the crows keep harassing him. I mean, he's really awesome, but I'm sure he did something to tick him off, but...
Well, the red-tail, probably the reason you don't have birds at your feeder. But, Scott, what do you think?
Well, there are a couple things related to the question. Where was our caller again?
Green Bay.
Yeah, so again, the further north you go, the less snow cover there is. And when there are periods of low snow cover, then birds are able to forage in a more normal pattern, and they may abandon feeders for a period of time. Plus, in the storm cycle we've had for the last couple of weeks, I notice at my own feeders that there have been periods, especially pre-storm, when the birds are just packed in. They're incredibly active, feeding heavily, and then they disappear during the storms and come back a day or two later. So I've actually been watching the birds for my immediate weather forecasts for the last couple of weeks, and they seem pretty good at it. So there is some natural explanations. There are other possibilities. You know, beyond the weather and the lack of snow cover, somebody else gets has a big feeding operation going, and they've distracted the birds for the time being. There are lots of possible explanations, but the one that I think concerns people most frequently is that there's something wrong, that something's gone wrong. The birds have gotten into something they shouldn't. They've migrated when they shouldn't have, whatever. But that's generally not the case. There are logical explanations, and keeping the feeders filled and being patient will usually mean they come back. And that's the long and short of it. The other thing that occurs, especially down here in the southern part of the state, to a lesser extent up north, is that because of a relatively open winter in the north so far, I haven't been seeing much by way of northern birds down here that I would typically see, like siskins and red poles and grosbeaks and assorted things like that. So if the weather hasn't been conducive to pushing those birds around, that's another group of birds that may or may not be at your feeders. And as long as we're on the topic, two things I wanted to mention, Larry. February is National Bird Feeding Month, so that's it's a timely topic in that regard. And February also marks the start and conclusion of the Great Backyard Bird Count. So all these folks who are watching their feeders and are interested in birds around the yard can log in to www.birdcount.org and follow the prompts and getting involved in having the data from their feeders feed into the national database. So while we're all confined, there's something you can do to contribute to citizen science, the Great Backyard Bird Count, and just feed your birds. It's a time of the year when they're dependent, and heck, it's National Bird Feeding Month. So anyway, as far as the red tail is concerned, you know, the red tails may be around. The red tails may be around. I had one in a tree watching my feeders the other day, but they're not major bird predators, not like Cooper's hawks or sharpshin or something like that. So that they may be around, but they're probably more interested in a rabbit or a squirrel or a mouse that's foraging under the bird feeder than they are the birds themselves. Now, the birds keep an eye on things, and you know, hawks sitting there may cause them a little immediate consternation, but the red tails aren't a huge threat to them. I had last week, we had two adult bald eagles foraging around the, well, my backyard is 12 acres, so it's a little bigger than a backyard, but we don't usually see bald eagles around, but they spent 2 or 3 hours circling over the prairie and landing in the trees. And we had some wild turkeys out too, and they were keeping a sharp eye on those eagles. So it pays for any of these birds or anything else to watch for predators, but red tails aren't a big threat to the feeder birds.
And the birds, the red tail and the hawks, I'm sorry, the red tail and the crows don't like them.
Crows are just have a rather unpleasant disposition. And when they find any raptor, particularly an owl, but also just about any hawk, they exhibit mobbing behavior, and their persistent squawking calls in all the crows in the area to join in the fun. And then they'll presumably harass the bird, the hawk or owl, out of the area and go back to whatever they were doing.
Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today, Larry Mueller here with my guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Join in with your own questions or comments about wildlife at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. John in Madison has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. Scott, could you talk a little bit about bobcats? And just, you know, kind of an overview. The reason for it is with all the trail cams out, mine included, we're starting to see more of these animals around, and I know very little about them. So whatever you can speak to, and I'll take it, whatever you got off the air.
All right. Thanks, John.
Well, John, I you didn't say where your trail cameras were, but I'm assuming they're somewhere around southern Wisconsin here. And I think the most interesting thing about bobcats is that they've been, for some time now, but especially recently as people are paying more attention because of trail cameras and the southwestern Wisconsin deer mortality study where they were looking at bobcats as a potential predator, all of a sudden people are realizing that bobcats, which were for a long time thought of as primarily a northern forest animal, are actually moving south and west down through western Wisconsin into southwestern Wisconsin and really over most of the state, and have become, I wouldn't say common, but certainly a whole lot more abundant than they once were in the Driftless area in the southwestern part of the state, even over here in Dane County. So not only are they turning up on trail cameras, but they were being captured alive as part of that predator study interaction with deer. And I forget how many they actually put radio collars on and marked, but it was a substantial number. And so they're out there. And because they're out there, people are seeing them or finding tracks or whatever, and therefore are curious. So they're one of our three native felids, cats. Mountain lions, of course, have attracted a lot of attention because they, too, have been better documented by trail cameras. I'll talk about that a little later, actually. There was a picture published just a couple weeks ago that was pretty good. And then lynx, which are extremely rare, and then bobcats. So as far as the wild cats are concerned, this is the most common one, and they're becoming much more widespread. They're a beautiful animal, luxurious pelt, very distinctive markings. There are features, you know, people, another contentious point, not contentious, but curious point, of course, when people see them, especially in the north, are often think, well, it must have been a lynx. Human nature is you always want to see the rarest thing possible, and a lynx is much more unusual than a bobcat. But there are characteristics of leg length and foot size and the black tip on the tail and ear tufts and so forth that make a lynx relatively easy to separate. So You know, that's the long and short of it, I guess, Larry. They're an easy thing to Google and see lots of pictures and comparisons or a field guide to the mammals. And then by the same token, you can pick up whatever you're interested in as far as breeding season or gestation period or litter size or whatever else. So the information is readily available, and so are the bobcats.
Okay. Well, Kathy in Hayward has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. Thank you for the program. Always learning something new, that's for sure. I know this seems like a simple question, but we have a bird feeder on a metal pole, and we put a metal baffle around it. But the squirrels have figured out how to get over that baffle. How do I keep the squirrels out of my bird feeder? Do I set up a separate feeder for them? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Oh, here we go, Larry. The age-old controversy with squirrels, currently raging in my backyard. You know, I was going to mention this anyway, Larry, but if you still have the YouTube site, remember the video the woman sent after our last program about
yes.
That was a fantastic video that anybody fighting squirrels should watch, because it quickly conveys just how difficult it is to build anything that they can't circumvent. And they learn very quickly to circumvent those things. However, there are a couple of things that she can do. There are some commercial feeders available that are weight balanced so that a bird can sit on the feeding ring or perch without closing it. But when the weight of a squirrel hits it, it essentially shuts the feeder ports so they can't
I've
get
I've got
food.
Two of those.
Yep. So that's one option. The other option is a bigger baffle. I don't know how they're circumventing it, but if it's wide enough that they can't get from the pole or the ground around the bend of the baffle, then they're out of luck. So a larger baffle or a baffle that's higher on the feeder might help. There are also some sticky or slippery things that can be applied to the pole supporting the feeder, although sometimes those can kind of mess up bird feathers and are a little risky. Beyond a baffle, there are also poles that have a sliding cylinder on them but it's spring loaded in the interior of the pole. So it rises, it sits high on the pole, but as a squirrel goes up the pole and gets on this sleeve, its weight, boom, carries it right back to the bottom and dumps it out on the ground. So that's another option for her. There are also some capsaicin-based or essentially hot pepper sauce-based powder additives to the seed, which the squirrels find objectionable, but birds don't. That's another possibility, and your bird feeding stores like Wild Birds Unlimited and others can help out with that kind of thing. But that's the long and short of it. It's a real battle, and even suspending a hanging feeder from a cable and running it out over the yard is not easy to solve, because the squirrels will go hand over hand right along that cable and lower themselves down. One thing Kathy mentioned that I wouldn't recommend is a feeder devoted to the squirrels, because the squirrels won't share and they won't restrict their activity to that feeder. So all that tends to do is attract more squirrels in the first place. So it's counterproductive. So it's
there you go, Kathy.
You know, I remember in previous programs years ago, we used to talk about a book that people might enjoy. It was called Outwitting Squirrels, and the author's name was Adler, A-D-L-E-R. And it's an entire book devoted to this battle with squirrels. So bottom line, Kathy, good luck.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Just sort of a related thing, Vicky was wondering why she's seeing so many squirrels without part of their tail and wondered what would cause that. So, you know, half the tail gone or something.
Well, it's a That's a good question, probably one I can't answer directly. There are a number of things, whether it be a close encounter with a predator or some other type of mechanical accident that might take the tip off a tail, but there are also some, if the squirrel otherwise looks healthy and doesn't show any sign of, you know, mange or ratty behavior that would suggest some sort of parasites that are causing hair loss, it's probably a mechanical injury. And I mean, it's hard to respond to that, not knowing whether this is, you know, one squirrel in 10 or nine squirrels in 10. The higher the percentage makes you wonder that accident is less of an explanation. But beyond that, there's nothing obvious I can point to.
Let's take another call. By the way, you can join in, too, with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly here. Gary in Genesee Depot will turn to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I've got a pond in my backyard. It's registered as a fish farm. And I've been trying to find somebody to come out and shock it so that I can get an inventory on the fish that are in there. I haven't been able to come up with any suggestions from anybody, and I'm wondering if you might have any.
Well, that's an interesting question. Not one I ever remember getting before, Gary. So, you know, it's the commercial or fish shocking equipment is pretty elaborate, and it's not something that you could do as a DIY project. When I was president of our lake association up in northern Wisconsin, I did interact with both the DNR and the Forest Service biologists to see about a routine shocking of our lake so that we could accomplish the same thing you're trying to accomplish. And it was very difficult to book their team. It requires a team of people and, again, some specialized equipment because electricity and water involved. It's not an easy thing to do. So my suggestion, not knowing how big your pond is, Gary, there are other ways to sample the fish, and that includes, if the bottom is safe, you know, a couple of friends in a 25-foot commercial seine can meander around in a shallow pond and pretty well quickly figure out what's in there. But similarly, there are a variety of net traps, like what's called a fyke net, F-Y-K-E, that can be set in the pond. And there's a long lead, a net lead that suspends from the surface and funnels all the fish moving along the shore into this net trap. And then you just pull it up, see what you've got for fish, count them, look at them, whatever, put them back. No fish are harmed in the procedure. And it might be easier to borrow a fyke net for a short period of time than the electroshocking equipment. So anyway, those are a couple of ideas. And the search for the electroshocking would start with your county fish manager from the DNR and go from there.
All right. There you go, Gary. Thank you so much for calling. Randy in Plover, let's go to you now. Hi, Randy.
Spence Walker has opened up state parks. Some of these smaller parks, I feel, can't handle the hunting pressure that is being put upon them. And I was wondering if the DNR or the wildlife is ever going to think about considering the wildlife pressure that's in some of these small state parks. Some of these, one of them, I know that I used to see gray squirrels in there all the time. Now you're lucky if you even see a gray squirrel in there because they wiped them all out.
Well, this is another, it seems like a straightforward question, but it's a bit more complicated than that because there are several opposing forces at work here. Most of the concern that I've heard about parks or such areas that are typically thought of as closed to hunting but reserved for other forms of recreation relates to deer hunting. And my personal position on that used to be, well, you know, the deer season's only 9 days around Thanksgiving. Here's an opportunity to do something to help control the deer herd where it needs control, provide a little extra hunting opportunity, and, you know, really it's a very short period of time for other people to feel excluded. Now, however, the deer season seems to be...
forever.
At least, I mean, it seems to be forever as far as I'm concerned, from September into literally, I think, into early February or certainly the end of January for something, either guns or bows or what have you. And that being the case, if there's exclusion of folks or people feel unsafe for that extended period, then I'm a bit more sympathetic to the problem. But the other force working in the other direction is that there's a lot of interest on the part of resource managers to provide as much hunting opportunity as they can, opportunity being access to property where people can hunt, which in some counties is not a big issue. If you're in northern Wisconsin, where the landscape is dominated by national forest, state forest, county forest, there's plenty of public land. You get into Dane County, for example, where Larry and I are right now, I think Dane County is only 3% public land. Yet there's a very large deer herd, and the County Deer Advisory Committee, of which I'm a part, struggles with how to get willing hunters, interested hunters, onto property where they can actually help with deer herd control in Dane County when such a huge majority of the land is privately owned and therefore privately controlled as far as access is concerned. So there'd be more pressure on public parks of any kind in an area like Dane County than there would be in northern Wisconsin. So bottom line is there are a lot of things to think about here, Randy, but I understand your concern, and it's something that needs to be taken up with, for example, during the spring Conservation Congress hearings that come up on a Monday night in early April. This is the kind of thing that can come up in individual counties. It's the kind of thing you can take before your state representatives in terms of the legislative process and your DNR people and see what happens. That's about, you know, it's not something I can control or Larry can control or we can give you a specific answer, but it's an issue of public use on public land, and the people who make the most compelling case usually have their way. So there you go.
Thanks for calling. Let's go to Ron in La Crosse next. Hi, Ron.
Yes, I'd like to know, I had a suet cake hanging on some tree in my planter box, and the birds never went after it. But a gray squirrel, full-grown gray squirrel, really went after it, and the birds left hardly anything for the birds. But my question is, I got another suet cake, put it in my suet cake holder, and hung it on a shrub, and the squirrels can't get at it, but the birds aren't going after it. What I want to know, I have sparrows and I think finches, and there are some cardinal once in a while. What type of suet cake would attract all three, or do I need to get different types for each bird?
No, I've tried a lot of different types of suet cakes, and primarily my suet feeders, I have three of them out, are all designed for woodpeckers. That's the group of birds that really hits suet hard. And I've got a pair of red bellies that I really enjoy and several other species, but just about any suet cake seems to be fine for them. As far as the other birds are concerned, while I occasionally see a chickadee or even a cardinal grab a seed that's exposed in the suet cake, they're more interested in the seeds than they are the suet matrix that holds the seed together. So as you're buying the suet cakes, you'll see different types of formulas. Some are berry blends and have fruit incorporated. Some have a lot of sunflower seed. Some are not much more than cornmeal and suet, which I don't find particularly attractive to very many birds. So I guess my advice, Ron, is to, if you don't have any woodpeckers around, you're probably better off with just feeding straight sunflower seed or a seed mix if you prefer, and the birds that you mentioned will be attracted to that and not particularly attracted to the suet. I just have the suet out because it diversifies the feeding station and really takes care of the woodpeckers, and the jays hit it pretty hard too. But
yeah,
I would look for a good quality suet cake that's got a high percentage of seeds in it, and that's what would probably help with the other species beyond the woodpeckers. But if you've got a good seed feeder, they're going to be working that over anyway. So
yeah, there you go, Ron. Thank you. Yvonne in Twin Lakes, on to you now. Hi, Yvonne.
Oh, this is one of the best programs ever. What I was concerned about is the predator animals, bobcats, wolves, coyotes, how dangerous are they with little kids being out at night playing in the snow in this cold weather? I have a neighbor that has, two neighbors that have chicken coops, and they send the little kids out at night to either bring the chickens in or harvest eggs or whatever, and I think it's rather dangerous. Could you comment about this?
Okay.
Well, Yvonne, this is one of those questions that that involves risk assessment that's very difficult to answer. Not because the answer is difficult, but because answering it is difficult. Because as soon as you say, well, it's absolutely no risk, don't worry about it, and then, God forbid, something happens, then it's not a good situation. If, on the other hand, you say, well, these are all carnivorous animals, and they're large and potentially dangerous, all of which is true. However, if you look at the statistics, the numbers of people who are out and about, especially for the last year with the pandemic, doing all sorts of things, ice fishing, snowshoeing, hiking, walking the dog, hunting, fishing, doing anything you can imagine outdoors. You know, how many reports have you seen in the paper about a snowshoer or a hiker or a dog walker or whatever being attacked or injured? I can't think of any. Larry, can you think of anything in the last year in Wisconsin?
No.
No. So it would be... Yes, there are, if you dig deep enough, mountain lion attacks, whatever, around North America, yes, you will find records of problems, but they are few and far between. And the animals, this sounds like kind of an old, sounds like something you just hear about, hey, these animals are more afraid of you than you should be of them. And that's actually true. The animals have a lot more to be concerned about from people on the landscape than the reverse. And as a result, they tend to give, especially kids who are, you know, yelling and playing and digging a snow fort or playing King on the Mountain or whatever, they would give them a wide berth. Someone outside corralling chickens in the dark when the chickens themselves are an attractant to some predators, you know, that seems like something where I'd want a bell or a good flashlight, or some other means of announcing my presence that would give a potential predator plenty of time to get the heck out of the way. So bottom line, it's not something that when I've got the grandkids over and they're out playing around in the corners of the property, not something I give a great deal of concern to compared to all the other things we need to worry about these days. So that's my kind of my thinking on the matter, Yvonne. You might get a different answer from somebody else, but it would not be high on my worry list. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't be cautious and respect all these animals if you know they're around.
Thanks, Yvonne. Appreciate your call. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here looking at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And you can join in 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Julie emailed some photos of her poor birch tree, which is almost gone anyway, but has a beautiful pileated woodpecker working away on it, probably getting some insects or larvae or whatever out of this old diseased tree that's going to be soon coming down. I'm pretty sure of that. Julie, thank you so much for sending that photo. Let's take another call, though. Norman in Wausau, it's your turn. Hi, Norman.
I want to mention to your audience, Larry, that we had an inordinate amount of problems this year, probably because there wasn't a good acorn crop around where we live, just north of Wausau. And what happened was the squirrels took, gray squirrels, took all our pears off of our, or almost all of them off of our first ripening pear tree. I would say they got 70 to 80% before I noticed that they were even gone. And then after that, they started on some of our early apples, and they really did a number on our butternut squash. I can't believe it, except we put trail cameras out to see what was doing it, and by golly, there they were, chewing away. So we know that that's what did it. But they wrecked about a third of our butternut squash by eating the substance of them. And as far as the feeders are concerned, we have a bird feeder out, and the squirrels haven't been able to get to it. It's got a pipe about 1 inch, and it's about 6.5 feet tall, and the feeder sits on top of it. And about a foot below it, I have a ring that's with a set screw that holds it there to hold the baffle, which is about 14, in diameter, it's probably 18 to 20 inches or so. But when they get onto that, if they try to get on that, that ring holds the baffle up, and the baffle tips down, so now the squirrel is trying to crawl straight up on a galvanized metal, and it can't do it. So knock on wood, we haven't had a single squirrel that's been up on there. We do have a lot of squirrels here, but none that got to the top of that feeder.
Oh, man, Norman, the squirrels got to my squash, too. I can tell you that. Scott, a comment.
Well, those darn squirrels, they're an incredibly agile, acrobatic, persistent animal. And, you know, they're not doing anything malicious. They're picking the low-hanging fruit, so to speak. And if the ground's covered with squash or the pear tree's covered with pears, they'll take advantage of it. So those kinds of problems are very difficult to contend with compared to Norman's successful protection of his bird feeder. But, you know, in a normal year when natural foods are relatively abundant or the crop fields are remaining unharvested, the squirrels will take care of themselves. But when conditions change, you better be ready to protect your stuff.
Thanks for calling, Norman. Appreciate it. Well, Dave in North Freedom, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Yeah, this is a question about the current deer population. I've done some reading, and I know historically we had a lot more woods, and that tended to favor elk, which outnumbered and could outcompete the deer. I'm a relatively new deer hunter, but most of the people I know that hunt maintain that the current deer population isn't near what it was back in the 50s. And my thinking is farming has taken over a large part of what used to be woods, and that has a lot higher carrying capacity, and people feed deer. So my guess is the deer population now is higher than it ever was historically. I know records are kind of here and there, but I'd be interested to hear your take on that.
Well, your take is interesting, Dave, going back, even to the 50s, because generally discussions about deer populations go from year to year at best and are relatively short-sighted, so to speak. But you're kind of taking the longer-term view here. In reality, farming has been mighty good for deer in Wisconsin, and the highest deer densities are in central Wisconsin, used to be southern Wisconsin, but of course chronic wasting disease has reared its ugly head primarily in the southern part of the state and elsewhere. So there are other factors going on, but you're fundamentally correct that the deer populations have been since about the 80s as high or higher than historically and as high as they've ever been. The heyday for deer harvest, which is a reflection of deer numbers, was from the from around the 90s into the early 2000s until CWD began to take hold. But the current issues in Wisconsin as far as deer numbers are very abundant well, the disease, of course, is something of a paramount concern, but substantial deer numbers in the southern and central part of the state and relatively low deer numbers in the north, which people variously blame on predators, land management, harvest, weather, and assorted other things. But the reality of the situation is the deer harvest, which again is something of a measure of both effort and the number of deer out there. The overall deer kill for this past season, that's all seasons, all tools, crossbows, bows, guns, and so forth, was up 16% from 2019 and was somewhere in the neighborhood of 335,000 animals. Not a record harvest by any means, but a good one and an improvement over last year. You may remember last year there were lots of problems with standing corn and weather and assorted other things. So from that standpoint, there was a substantial deer harvest, which suggests good deer numbers. The north, of course, is still a sore point, and there's lots of debate over that. So I guess, you know, the deer have changed their distribution over the years, not by moving physically individual deer, but by the population flourishing in some parts of the state because of land use issues and not flourishing in other parts because of some of the issues I just mentioned. But overall, the deer population's in pretty good shape, again, the north notwithstanding, and there are still issues with overabundant deer in some counties, especially counties with urban areas, and that kind of thing is going to persist for the foreseeable future because the deer are quite capable of taking care of themselves. But deer hunters and people interested in them have a wide variety of opinions. And that came home to me just a few weeks ago reading some 500 comments submitted by the public to our county Deer Advisory Committee here in Dane County, and I read all of those hundreds of comments, and I was taken by the incredible diversity of people's opinions. Too many deer, not enough deer, can't get on the land, have my own land, crossbows are the end of civilization as we know it, crossbows are the greatest thing since sliced bread, this, that, and the other thing. It was just amazing to consider the diversity of opinions and then try and be put in a position to, like the DNR is every year, or these county deer advisory committee meetings, what the heck are we going to recommend for this county? There's no sense of consensus. Anyway, it's a challenge, but the deer are doing pretty well. Again, the disease, not with chronic wasting disease, notwithstanding, and you know, life goes on as far as deer management is concerned.
Yeah,
I don't know if that got to your complete question, Dave, but the point is there's still plenty of deer out there, and we just had a very successful deer season.
Thanks again, Dave, for calling. Connie in Portage, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Connie.
Hi, Larry, and hello to your guest. I agree with him on the suet. Usually I have a lot of woodpeckers.
Oh, I think we lost Connie.
Oh, man, and she was going to talk about woodpeckers, too.
She said they've got a lot of woodpeckers on their suet feeders. So she was commenting that you're right. I think she was making the comment that you're right about suet and woodpeckers. I'm sorry we lost you, Connie. Well, let's see. We got time for Lori here in Shawano. Hi.
Hi, I have a fenced-in yard, and whatever I have in the house that's biodegradable and can throw out, I just throw over the fence and let the animals pick through it and eat what they will. Well, I had some mozzarella cheese that had exploded in the container, and I just threw some of that over thinking that raccoons or something would eat it. But it looks like the blue jays have been eating it, And I think there's a family of five out there because I thought I saw one blue jay feeding another one day. Do they stay in a family unit like that for a while?
Yeah, they seem to. My wife's become very enamored of throwing a handful of shelled peanuts out onto the deck by one of our feeding stations every morning when we get up. And it's as if the jays are sitting up there somewhere or have a post, or maybe they've got their own little trail cameras. I don't know. But they know when those seeds hit the deck, those peanuts, and boom, there they are. And there are always between four and five of them. They seem to communicate with each other. They stay together. And my speculation is that that's a pair and young, extended family, flock, call it what you like, but they're behaving socially, and they stay like that throughout the year.
Yeah, there you go, Lori. Thank you so much.
But I have to say, Lori, be careful with throwing all sorts of food over your fence. It, you know, while it's nice to see it put to some use, you can attract some real problems with raccoons and possums and rodents and assorted other things. So be careful with that.
Yeah, be careful with that. And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He'll be with us right up till 12:30. We will take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. And then we will be right back with Scott. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Have you with us here on the Ideas Network as we take a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in. So what questions do you have about wildlife? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email at ideas@wpr.org. Tom in Fish Creek has a question for us. So let's go there. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry and Scott. Scott, I'm hoping you might talk a little bit about bears and hibernation, why they do it, the timeline of going in, what happens if bears come out of hibernation, and do other mammals hibernate?
Well, hibernation, it always comes up this time of year because yesterday was Groundhog Day, and then there's some debate over what animals are true hibernators, in other words, animals that dramatically drop their body temperature and overall metabolic rate, and, I mean, they're really out of it, as opposed to animals that are more deep sleepers, don't have tremendous drops in their body temperature and kind of in a state of dormancy, and bears fall into that category. So if you're curious about the physiology and all, then I'd recommend that you Google it or check a mammalogy text and get the specifics about the tremendous changes, physiological changes, that a true hibernator, like a ground squirrel, for example, goes through when they're in hibernation. But the fundamental purpose it's just one of a number of strategies to deal with this wretched weather we seem to have in the winter here in Wisconsin. Some animals, birds that are, and some bats that are capable of long-distance movement, hey, their strategy is like snowbirds, human snowbirds, let's get the heck out of here and head south. That works for them. For other animals like the squirrels and fox and raccoons and possums and so forth that we've talked about earlier on the program, their strategy is just, hey, it's going to be really cold the next 4 or 5 days. We're going to den up and just hide out in a hollow tree, in a ground den or whatever, and wait it out. And the other strategy, of course, is hibernation or winter torpor, not true hibernation, but everybody thinks of it that way, of just sleeping it off, staying kind of like we've all been forced to do because of COVID-19, stay in the house, sleep a little more, eat a little more, and stay out of harm's way. So that's the rationale behind it. In the case of these animals denning up, that usually occurs in the case of bears you asked about in November. There are some differences between the sexes and ages in terms of who dens up first, but they're usually all in dens by the time Thanksgiving, the deer season, rolls around, although climate changes have extended that a little bit later in the year. And then they're up and about in the spring when the thaw starts. And in the case of bears, they're hungry and they're kind of grouchy. And they're out roaming around on the landscape looking for about anything they can find to eat. So that's, I guess, it in a nutshell, Tom. Nutshell. But there are lots of good references on it, especially if you're interested in the physiology behind it.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Ken in Chippewa County, it's your turn. Hi, Ken.
Yeah, hi. This is just a follow-up to the gentleman. And well, first of all, I want to say how much I've enjoyed over the years your program, Scott and Larry. I consider this a real privilege to be able to connect with you here.
Thank you.
Yeah, following up with the gentleman with this, you know, reporting on the squirrels being hungry, I'm observing something in northern Chippewa County that I'm in the woods a lot, in fact, on a weekly basis, and seeing something I haven't seen in over 50 years of being out there, and that is the squirrels are stripping the bark, you know, girdling soft maple trees 20, 30, 40 feet up the trunk. They're so desperate for a food source, apparently, and we got a little clue of this back in late November, early December, that the forest floor was littered with new growth being nipped off of spruce trees. Apparently they were after the buds. And so it was just carpeted underneath spruce areas. And now we see the maples being girdled. And this is not just in a few places. This is widespread, hundreds of trees. And I wondered if you've got any information on this. Is this a regional or local thing? Or do you think it's more wide-ranging regional? And is it related to oak tree problems or anything like that, and lacking food?
Well, that's an interesting one, Ken. But before I say anything about the squirrels, I appreciate your comments on the program. Larry and I have enjoyed doing it for many, many years. Of course, Larry's on every day. I'm only on every other month now, but I still do enjoy it, and realized the other day I've been retired for 10 years now, but you know, as long as Larry hangs in there, I think I will too. But anyway, back to the squirrels. This notion of bark stripping occasionally occurs when I was getting more calls and more in the loop. Occasionally occurs in various parts of the state. I used to see accounts on golf courses and in parks, for example, where they would strip the bark off particularly soft maples, but a few other species as well. Then it often looked like, if the tree was stripped low, it looked like a buck rub, that the bark was shredded by a buck rubbing the bark, and that caused some misplaced control. But then I got reports in the winter of them stripping bark off arborvitae or white cedar, although I think they were using that for nesting material. But there were occasionally persistent reports of stripping large trees, particularly maples. And oddly enough, I remember the Eau Claire area and west central Wisconsin as being kind of a hotbed for that, and I have no explanation for that, but that's not far from you. Anyway, I can remember accounts of 30, 40, 50-foot mature maples where particularly the more slender limbs and branches where the bark was thinner were stripped almost white, so you could see them from a great distance. What the heck's wrong with that tree? Well, the squirrels had stripped all the bark off, presumably to get at the cambium or the inner bark as a food source. I would assume that this tends to be accentuated when it's a bad winter and there's not much else. Either the corn crop was early and complete in terms of harvest, a lousy year for acorns, or a whole host of things coming together. On the other hand, some of these animal behaviors seem to be learned behaviors and spread from animal to animal, and may just occur because a population of squirrels has figured out, hey, this is an easy access food supply, and therefore it could be more common in some areas than others. But it does seem to be food-driven. It does seem to be erratic in its occurrence, but it can, as you pointed out, affect very large trees and a lot of trees, and it looks really weird. And that's about all I can tell you about it, Ken, except it does occur, but the rhyme or reason to it is a little trickier to get at.
And thanks a lot for calling, Ken. We had an email from Adam in Eau Claire. He was wondering where he can find, where information can be found on state and federal incentives for providing habitat and wildlife certifications for tax credit.
That all has to go through various federal agencies. For example, programs like CRP, the Conservation Reserve programs, and others that have wildlife habitat components are handled through FSA, the Farm Services Group. And there are also private land biologists familiar with all the federal programs that are stationed in Wisconsin, and I think the central office is in Madison, and chances are any of the DNR biologists could inform someone or at least steer them to the right office in their own county. But that's all, those programs are all handled by state or federal agencies, either related to farms and agriculture or wildlife in the case of the Fish and Wildlife Service or the DNR. So that's a matter of a couple phone calls to the local agencies. And I'd start with the DNR and FSA and see what Adam can find out specific to his interests.
And I would just sort of in a side note here, I know the DNR has an open house on February 10th, I wanted to mention, with the Deer Management Assistance Program, or DMAP.
Yes.
It's a cooperative effort for people to manage their property for wildlife. And they have a Zoom meeting on February 10th at 7 p.m. And you don't have to register. Anybody can join in. And that DMAP program does help manage help people manage their property for wildlife. And so I thought that was worth mentioning as well.
It is. It's a very. It's become a very important program. It's very well managed, and it was one of the recommendations and an offshoot of the old Deer Trustee report, and the people who were involved in that back in, I think it was about 2012. As long as we're on that, may I mention a couple other things coming up, Larry, that people might
sure.
be interested in? One is that since I won't be back on now until early April, April 21st is the virtual induction ceremony for the four new members of the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. And people can certainly sign up for that, and they can get information from the the Conservation Hall of Fame website. And that's on April 21st. There were a couple of other things. For example, for folks interested who are hunting or hunters, there are a lot of deadlines coming up over the next 4, 5, 6 weeks for applications for various Western hunting opportunities. The Western states, Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, and so forth, all have deadlines for permit applications for species like elk, mule deer, antelope, that kind of thing. And if you snooze, you lose on those applications. Then our spring turkey hunting season will be coming up. I think the first period starts April 21st or somewhere in there. So that's not too far in the future. And there's been a lot of things in the paper, perhaps because people are, you know, having more time to pay attention to these types of things related to, just a couple things that come to mind. The pandemic effects on hunting and fishing participation and outdoor recreation. Deer license sales this year were up 4%. And I keep getting reports from friends who are spending more time outdoors than I am that, holy cow, there seemed to be more ice fishermen than usual, and there were more people on the public pheasant properties and so on. So there's been a tremendous increase in those kinds of participation. The question now for the agencies is whether we can keep those people engaged in it and what that means for future recreational opportunities. And then lastly, one note on purple martins, a bird that a lot of people are interested in. There have been some interesting accounts come out lately on the fact that those birds are almost entirely dependent now on provisioned housing. In other words, these big martin colony boxes or gourd arrays that people have been putting up for years, that's the only game in town now as far as the martins seem to be concerned. But the critical thing is that if people put those up, they have to be managed and make sure that the sparrows and starlings and nest competitors are excluded and the martins are able to use those houses. So that's another interesting thing for people who have those martin houses up. And, oh, I don't know, there's a ton of other stuff going on, Larry, but, one other thing. If we get a chance here before the end of the program, I'd like to put in a plug for that taxidermy exchange that we've done on the radio for many, many years. It's spiraling out of control for me, so I need some help from the listeners. So that's
well,
it.
And on that, how do people help on that taxidermy business?
Well, the short background is we've talked before about the opportunity to find people who are trying to get rid of taxidermy they no longer want and get it in the hands of people like nature centers and schools and so forth who would like to have it to display. And this was years ago that we first did this, Larry, but I still get two or three collections a week, most weeks, that people want me to help place. But they're from all over the country. So what I need is to rejuvenate my list of recipients. People at nature centers around the state or office, whoever might want some.
Libraries.
Libraries, anybody that wants the stuff, send me an email. It's srcraven@wisc.edu. And or spread the word. If you're a member of a nature center, but hey, maybe the appropriate people aren't listening, you know, bring it up at a meeting or something. If you want this stuff, I need to know who you are, where you are, and the contact information so I can try and match things up with things people have that are close by an interested recipient, because it's not easy to ship this stuff. And I can't run all over the United States, you know, throwing it in the back of the truck and trying to distribute it. And some of these collections that I get have hundreds of specimens. And I feel badly not being able to help these folks. But anyway, if people want things, send me the information and be patient. When a match comes up, I'll try and help people out.
There we go. And let's go back to the phones. And David in Stoddard, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hello. I was calling about, I had a little incident Sunday evening, early evening, with a bobcat.
Mm-hmm.
I live out in the country in the middle of kind of nowhere. And Sunday about 6 p.m., I noticed down by the barn by my driveway, there was a bobcat down there. And then he come walking all the way up to the house, or she, whichever it is. And got within 10 feet of the house. And when I turned the doorknob on the door, it took off. But what I'm wondering, I had been told that possibly it came up around the house because they're in heat.
I doubt that. Around our cabin up in Price County, we've had them, see movement outside, turn on the light, and the bobcats are walking through the yard, or in one case, maybe it was last winter or the winter before, one actually turned and put a couple paws up on the back steps, which are up one story recessed, and started to head up toward the back door. And, hey, that's pretty cool. Let's get a picture. And it turns out that a couple of the neighbors were, throwing out an occasional piece of a deer carcass or something else, and the bobcats had figured out that this was, that checking out houses was a possible food source, or sometimes there's pet food left outside or whatever. So it's far more likely that they're just out on the prowl at night checking out any possible food source, but usually a noise, like in your case, the doorknob or flicking on a light or banging on the window or whatever, they're gone in a flash. It's one of those things, a neat thing to see. And a pretty low risk factor. So
there you go.
There you go.
Thanks, David. Ben in Oshkosh. Hi, Ben.
Hi there.
Hi, what can we do for you?
So I'm in the car with my 5-year-old daughter, and we love woodpeckers. You guys were about to hit on woodpeckers earlier, and then I think we skipped over a lady that you lost connection with. We live on Lake Winnebago. We hang suet and a bunch of other budget bird feed and watch the birds about 3 or 4 feet outside of our big bay windows. It's an awesome spot. We got a great view, a lot of sunshine. How do we attract more? Are there unique things that attract them? And what else? Say hi, McKenna.
Hello. Well, I think, Larry, the general question there is what can you do to attract more stuff than you already have?
And yeah, especially woodpeckers. Especially woodpeckers.
You know, woodpeckers are interested in suet, but there's one thing about woodpeckers. They are usually attracted to wood, which is why they're called woodpeckers. So, you know, in part with attracting these things to a home, you have to play the hand you're dealt. If you're in a relatively new subdivision and there are no mature trees, you can probably hang out all the suet cakes that you want and with no success because it's simply not the right habitat. If on the other hand, you're on an older, heavily wooded lot, then you're home free. The woodpeckers are going to be there and they'll respond to suet. As a general rule of thumb, the more diverse the habitat is around your home, your feeding station, and the more diversity you can create in your feeding operation in terms of different types of feeders, different seeds, different types of suet cakes, all those things will eventually help, and the birds will respond to it as well as other animals. But you're kind of creating mature vegetation is a long-term proposition. So go with your strong suit, keep the bird feeders filled, and the birds will find it.
Yeah, and if you've got a tree that's dying or dead, then it's not right near the house where it would be a danger, you could leave it up and leave it stand.
Yep.
Leave it stand. A lot of things will come to it for sure. Chris wanted to know if bluebirds are, is it normal to see bluebirds at this time of the year? Chris is in Richland Center.
It's not normal. Usually they'd clear out. They're primarily insect eaters, but I think if I look back on my records, I've probably seen a bluebird in every month of the year here in Wisconsin, including the dead of winter, but it's not common. And, you know, it may mean a bird that kind of got left behind or may have been sick, injured, whatever, but, or some things like robins and bluebirds, if there's a spring that provides a water source and a little relative warmth, a few may hang around throughout the season. So uncommon, but hey, it happens.
It is common that we run out of time, and here we have, we've done that, Scott. Thanks for being with us, and we'll look forward to your next visit on April 7th. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today. Sorry we didn't get to everybody. Tomorrow at 11, our consumer protection experts are back to give us an update on the latest scams and how you can avoid them. That's tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening, and hey, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.